The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Carlisle and the Ladies of the Go-Go's, little Our Lips Are Sealed from that debut album. Number one record in America 40 years ago today, 1982. That's right, Mark Davison for Hugh Hewitt, helping absolutely everyone feel older than they probably are. All right, if there's anything cooler than driving around listening to the first hour of Hugh Hewitt and hearing the David M. Drucker segment, it's hosting for you and getting to talk to the author of In Trump's Shadow, The Battle for 24 and the Future of the GOP, Mr. Drucker. Hi, how you doing?
Hey, good to be here. Thank you.
So I'm looking at everybody in the midst of the Ukraine drama and seeing where a lot of the flow of information seems to come. I think Marco Rubio, or a staffer of his, is up 24-7. His Twitter feed is one of the doggonest information sources for the latest in Ukraine. He is Senate Intel Chairman, but what is it that finds Rubio as like this intentional major conduit for updating us on every bit of the Ukraine minutiae? I'm pretty fascinated by it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Look, I mean, you know, foreign policy is a big issue for Rubio. It has been since he ran for the Senate the first time in 2010. He's always been very dialed in on foreign policy. He's currently ranking Republican on Intel because Democrats control the floor, but in line to be chairman again if they win the majority, I believe, according to term limits for chairman. I think he's still got time left. And this is just something that animates him. And in fact, you know, over the past 5 or 6 years or so, he's sort of gone through a metamorphosis or evolution from a domestic policy standpoint, coming up and proposing this big agenda full of populist conservative policies when it comes to domestic industrial policy, things having to do with manufacturing and job creation. And he's much more neutral or hospitable to the idea of union organizing than most Republicans than he was. One area where he has not changed at all, in my view, is on matters of foreign policy and national security. Still very hawkish, still very internationalist when it comes to projecting American power abroad. And I just think that this, given the pipeline of information he has as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, it makes a lot of sense that he would be talking a lot about this. And he's just very policy focused anyway. There's a story of in Trump's shadow where they decide they're going to go on this big messaging kick about stock buybacks because Rubio opposes stock buybacks. And, you know, he comes in the next morning and basically has read a mountain full of briefing papers and designed the entire, you know, Twitter string that they thread that they had talked about. And that's just Rubio. He reads a lot, digests a lot. You may disagree with him, but this is just how he functions on issues.
You had to know in writing In Trump's Shadow that the book would come out and then history would continue to unfold. Other books would come chronicling the Trump era. Did you catch Bill Barr on Special Report last night?
I have not yet caught the interview. I was in a meeting. I was actually working.
I'll give you 30 seconds. And I'll hand it to you because Bill Barr, it kind of like Pence, is trying to navigate a world in which you want to be sufficiently appreciative of the good things the administration did because you served that administration, and yet you feel the necessity to distance from what they both clearly think is Trump's mania, the inability to let go of the loss. Can somebody triangulate that with skill?
They can. I just think it sort of depends on how voters react. I mean, this is the sort of complication of Trump, is that on the one hand, his agenda, divorced from him, it can be a pretty popular agenda when polled, at least many elements of it. And, you know, as far as Republicans go, he accomplished a lot of things that Republicans are really happy with and in some cases had wanted for a long time and had not been done. On the other hand, you just have Trump and his reaction to 2020, not just his inability to let it go, but the different things he tried to do to remain in office, which, you know, particularly in the case of Mr. Pence, trying to get him to claim constitutional powers that don't exist. And so I think for a lot of Republicans, it's very difficult. And there's also this challenge, because I think there are many Republican voters, not a majority, but there are some subset of Republican voters that like the idea of keeping Trumpism without Trump, but don't like it when people badmouth Trump. And so you've got to walk this line of appreciating the agenda, appreciating the accomplishments, appreciating the change in direction of the party, without embracing some of the more problematic aspects of Trump, all while not making voters think you're bad-mouthing him.
It's a very difficult thing to do. You've identified the nuance precisely correctly, to the surprise of no one. This is why he's a great writer and a great guy to follow. At David M. Drucker on Twitter, in Trump Shadow. Grab it on Amazon now. David, thank you so much. Appreciate it. So I want to talk a little bit about the politics of Ukraine. The first thing we care about is the human tragedy. But how's it working out for Republicans, Democrats, Biden, everybody else? Byron York next. Mark Davis filling in for Hugh here on Tuesday. Stick around.
Take it away, and thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Hugh, and no shortage of same. Oh, my goodness gracious. 1 hour in on the Hugh Hewitt program, and I remain riveted, not just by the events coming in from Ukraine. Obviously, and my heart and my brain are engaged, and they're very different processes. My heart just screams out, what in the world can we do to stop these atrocities? And then when you get the answers like, oh, I don't know, bomb that convoy that still seems to be sitting there for no reason, take definitive action as America has done at various times, then you get into that desire, that intellectual part kicks in and say, yeah, but do we really want to start World War III? And would we necessarily do so? And another interesting thing, and as we welcome Byron York, first of all, welcome Byron, always great to have, great to hear you, and great to talk to you when I do the Hugh Hewitt Show. Nice to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It is on that exact point that I go right into something that you paid attention to on Twitter, at Byron York, and that is a fascinating Quinnipiac poll asking Americans if, and I don't think the question was if Putin invaded America. I think the question was, if you guys were Ukrainians, what would you do? Stay and fight or get the heck out of Dodge? And though there was some interesting, what was your main takeaway from what people said?
Well, it is an extraordinary poll. It's just one of those questions that I don't think any other pollster had thought of. And it said, as the world witnesses what is happening to Ukraine, they asked, what would you do if they were in the same position as Ukrainians are now? Would you stay and fight, or would you leave the country? Now, a majority said that they would stay and fight. Let me see. I can get there, actually. Here's the actual question. Mm-hmm. If you were in the same position as Ukrainians are now, do you think that you would stay and fight or leave the country? And the result was, and this is all adults, stay and fight 55%, leave the country 38%, don't know, which is not a crazy position, 7%. What was interesting is that there was a strong partisan difference in the stay and fight and leave the country numbers. Republicans were 68% stay and fight, and 25% leave the country.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats were 40% stay and fight, and 52% leave the country.
Of course they were.
So it's a look. I mean, people in Ukraine are leaving the country because it's intolerable. The Russian invasion has created an intolerable situation in which they face incredible suffering, if not death, by staying. So, you know, leaving the country for people, you know, heading to Poland for people in Ukraine is an entirely rational act.
Of course
it is. On the other hand, we do celebrate and admire those Ukrainians who are staying and fighting. So it's an interesting question, and I'm not going to draw, like, huge conclusions from it, but there's a big partisan difference here among Americans who were asked to put themselves in the same position. And a significant majority of Republicans, 68%, said they would stay and fight, while a minority, 40% of Democrats, said they would stay and fight.
Then let's bring it to this country and the fascinating political bedfellows being made by this entire Ukrainian drama that's playing out before us. I can find Republicans who say not one step into American military involvement. I can find other Republicans who say it is past time for us to be in a no-fly zone. I can find Democrats similarly split. What does that mean?
Well, I think it means our politics is in an interesting place. And this is something that I think that Donald Trump kind of recognized, didn't create, he recognized it. In 2015, and I think we're still there. I think there were a lot of Republicans, for example, who were in favor of the United States getting out of Afghanistan fully, but they were appalled at how badly Biden did it. But, I mean, the actual goal of getting out of Afghanistan, obviously that's something that Trump had wanted, and there were a lot of voters who wanted to get out because the United States had been there for 20 years. So there was this kind of partisan, overlap among Republicans and Democrats. So I think you're seeing something, similar now. I do think, there's a bipartisan consensus in the top leadership that it would be a bad idea for the United States to be involved in a shooting war in Ukraine, or any of its NATO allies to be involved in a shooting war in Ukraine, thus triggering our NATO treaty obligations to defend them. So that's why you've seen the debate you've seen about no-fly zone. On the other hand, and I'll shut up in just a minute, but we will see, I think everyone realizes, that if Russia continues and just begins to just execute a scorched earth attack in Ukraine, widening the suffering, widening the death, you will see increased pressure on Joe Biden to do something like a no-fly zone.
And speaking of pressure on Joe Biden, there's pressure every day for him to stop buying Russian oil, and he just won't do it. When Nancy Pelosi has clarity on this, what does it mean for Biden?
Now, that's interesting. The whole Pelosi thing was interesting. She came out and just said, yeah, stop. A lot of the politics of this war, both in Europe and here, is driven by the environmental lobbies in both countries. I mean, the Europeans are in such a dreadful position as far as energy is concerned because, the Germans, for example, shut down all of their nuclear plants. And the idea is to go to a renewable energy future, but they're not there yet. So they end up having to purchase a lot of fossil fuels, mostly natural gas, and they do it from Russia. So the Germans quickly shot down the idea of just not buying any more energy from Russia because they can't survive without it. The United States can survive without it. But a lot of Republicans, mostly Republicans, are pointing out that, we were a net energy exporter under President Trump, and that's no longer the case, and we ought to get there again. I understand energy is fungible. It's not like everything produced in the United States is then used in the United States and, we're self-sufficient. But when you produce enough to do that, then you are not dependent on foreign oil. So I think the interesting thing is, remember John Kerry brought this up early on in the Ukraine invasion, saying he hoped it wouldn't affect the climate talks going on. Amazingly enough, Russia invades Ukraine in kind of a World War II style conflict, and a lot of the talk in the capitals of Europe and the United States is about the environment.
It is a stunning, stunning tone deafness. Byron York is here, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. Last question is born of my cynicism. I don't want to be too cynical, and it's not like this would be bad, but do you feel like people who are coming into the fray and sharing their thoughts, that many of them, from Cotton to Rubio to Pompeo, all guys I love, are sharing from the heart what they feel, but also just maybe burnishing some 2024 credentials in an election where foreign policy may still be a big deal?
Sure. All three of them are running for president or would want to run for president or are running kind of conditional races for president if Donald Trump doesn't run for president. I mean, there's a big Republican field if President Trump doesn't run. So, of course they are. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, this is the way our system works.
Right.
And Pompeo and Cotton and others, if they have higher ambitions, I mean, it's a good thing for them to stake out positions on these issues.
Mm-hmm. It is. And so if with 60 seconds, you said there's a big field if Trump doesn't run. Is there any field if he does? Who are the people who you really absolutely think will still run, even if Trump does? The list starts with DeSantis. Where else does it go?
It's interesting because, I mean, I've had people, well-connected people in Iowa and other early states say, look, Trump would clear the field if he did run. I think people have to determine whether Trump is actually, by 2023, today, is actually a paper tiger. Now, personally, I believe there should be a multi-candidate and vigorous primary and caucus season. There is no incumbent president in the Republican Party right now, which is when you usually just have a coronation. So I think there should be. I think that if you have signs of a weakening Trump position, and it's a weakening Trump position because time moves on.
Of course it does.
And there are a ton of
people who love Trump and thank God he was president every day who might be thinking, I don't know, time to pass the baton. Byron York, always a joy. Follow him at Byron York and look for him in the Washington Examiner. Mark Davison for Hugh Hewitt. More of you on the phone next. Stick around. Throwing down some Eagles for Randy Meisner, some Monkees for Mickey Dolenz. For the 80s kids, little Gary Newman. Hope you invested well off this record. The great Gary Newman is 64 today, so spreading the love. Mark Davison for Hugh Hewitt. Great to have you here. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Davis. And every time I come in to do the program for Hugh, I was sort of comb the commentary world and see if I can find things that are interesting. And then I toss things to Danielle and say, hey, can you find this guy? And I'm so glad she did in this case. Joshua Huminsky is the director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs. That's a lot of syllables. We'll ask him what that is. But it's his piece in The Hill, an opinion piece that says, beyond sanctions, we must be smart, cautious, and creative with Russia. I want to find out what he means about that as we look out across the landscape of opinion. Mr. Huminsky, welcome. How are you doing, sir?
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Very nice to have you. So if I gather a bunch of people and say, look, sanctions are great, but the sanctions alone might not work, and we use the adjectives in the headline of your piece on The Hill, smart, cautious, and creative, what strikes you as smart? If the sanctions, because right now they're not doing it, they may at some point wear Putin down. But what if we're halfway through March, working our way into April, and it just looks like he is sanctions resistant?
Well, I think you nailed it right on the head there. I mean, sanctions are the easy button of American foreign policy. It's the thing that we've been hitting every single time Russia does something that we don't like. And if you don't think that Putin and the inner circle and the oligarchs around Putin haven't factored that into their calculus in the way that they do business, you'd be sorely mistaken. That's just unfortunately now a cost of doing business for them because we've been doing it for so long and having so little effect. Now, you're absolutely right that the sanctions are going to take some time to have an effect, and you're already starting to see some initial impact in the economy. The ruble has dropped precipitously. The Russian stock market, I believe, is closed probably through the rest of this week, if not longer. And to your point about what happens come mid-March, come longer in March, we're going to be left with very few options. We will have expended the sanctions tools, and this is where the risk of potential escalation starts to creep in. And when I start talking about being smart and being cautious, you're starting to see calls in the commentariats as well as sort of international pundits about the imposition of a no-fly zone for the sake of argument. Mm-hmm. Now, a no-fly zone, for your listeners, is not just some magic bubble that descends and all of a sudden the Russians won't be able to fly. A no-fly zone means it has to be enforced, which means you're going to have NATO or American pilots engaging Russian pilots and Russian ground troops, potentially targets inside of Russia. And that is a very slippery, escalatory slide to potential conflict and expanded conflict, which I think Putin has been reluctant to do thus far. I think that's why you haven't really seen a lot of cyber attacks That's certainly why you haven't seen anything against NATO states, because of the risk of escalation and expansion. So when we start thinking about being creative, we need to start defining the effects that we want. And right now, the immediate effect that we want is a cessation of hostilities, the provision of humanitarian aid and assistance to the Ukrainian people, both in Ukraine, but also in the European states surrounding Ukraine. It is an increase of armaments and munitions to the Ukrainian military to raise the cost of doing business to Russia. But it's trying to find ways to influence that audience of one, which is Putin. And if you back Putin into a corner, he's more likely to potentially behave in a way that we would not necessarily say is rational, but for his perspective and from the Russian perspective is rational. So calls for regime change are very dangerous. Leaving him without ways of saving face is very dangerous. And that's where I think it's interesting that we have not really seen much in terms of the way of an articulated end state that we want yet. Russia came out, I believe it was yesterday. Dmitry Peskov, a Kremlin spokesperson, articulated 5 points that would lead to an immediate end to hostilities for the Russians. And Zelensky came back and said no to any ultimatums in terms of demilitarization or amending Ukraine's constitution, but that Crimea and the DNR and LNR regions, which recently declared independence, could potentially be on the table. And this is where we need to realize that war and diplomacy happen simultaneously. They do not happen independently of one another. You don't just stop fighting and then start talking. You're continuing to talk while you're fighting. And I think that, for me, that's part of the alarming situation, is that we're not seeing that component yet. In the run-up to the war, you saw a lot of shuttle diplomacy. You know, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, was going back and forth to Moscow to meet with Putin. Sullivan and Blinken were going back and forth from the United States to Russia. But we need to start really thinking creatively as what it is we want to achieve, and then start designing tools and creating opportunities to have that outcome happen.
Man, I'm glad we called you. Josh Uminski is the director of the Mike Rogers. That was spectacular. Put that on a continuous loop, and that's it. And one of my favorite quotes from you is that war and diplomacy are not like a binary switch on, switch off thing. They run on parallel tracks. And you touched on the psychological element, which is so vital to everything. We are counting on Putin. First of all, I don't know what to make of this. From Rubio to Condi Rice, there are people who wonder if maybe he has all of his marbles right now. I don't know. I can't figure that out with our own president, much less any foreign leader. So I'll just sort of leave that in the ether. But you touched on something really important, and that is that being bellicose and doing a lot of saber rattling and talking tough. I'm a big fan of talking tough. I'm a big fan of acting tough. But it seems that you're painting a picture where somebody through a back channel had better be giving him an exit ramp in which he saves face. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. I think you nailed it right on the head. And that's one of the things that I think we're walking to a situation where we're not creating that. I mean, if we're discussing the sanctions, for example, they're going to take some time to have an effect. And what it's going to lead to Putin is, in all likelihood, a prosecution of the war to whatever logical end he wants in an accelerated timetable. If that's taking Kiev, if that's taking Odessa, if that's creating a land bridge between Crimea and the Donbass region, he's going to realize that those reserves that he built up prior to the instigation of the war are going to run out fairly quickly. Now, of course, a state can prosecute a war to whatever end it wants to, and it'll find creative ways to finance that. But those sanctions are going to have a significant impact in the long term on the people who are not necessarily the targets of that. And if we don't create a way to say, hey, Russia, if you do X, we will reconnect you to the global economy, you will have no incentive to do so. And when you're punishing the Russian people, and let's be clear, we're dealing with the Putin regime, not the Russian people. When you're punishing the Russian people, you're filtering into Putin's narrative, which has been happening since, you know, circa 2014, but arguably earlier, that the West is at war with the Russian people, which is demonstrably not the case. We are at war, or you know, the Ukrainians are at war, and we are in conflict with Russian foreign policy and Russian security policy. So separating those two are critical, but as you said, leaving an exit strategy for Putin where he saves face and looks like he has managed to achieve whatever ends he wanted to achieve. I mean, the denazification and demilitarization, completely false narrative that the Kremlin is pushing out, that's obviously not viable. But saying, you know, we will, you know, cede Crimea indefinitely, DNR and LNR will be independent territories. You must remove all of your forces from Ukraine and go back to the circa 2021 borders, for the sake of argument. That is an exit strategy that will leave him a way to walk out claiming some sort of victory. If we have a unilateral, you must withdraw to the 2014 pre-Euromaidan borders, when Crimea was annexed and then Donbass was invaded, that's probably going to be a non-starter. And that's where you start running down the pathway of creating fewer and fewer exit routes for Putin.
You know what he wants? He also really wants a total promise that Ukraine will never join NATO. I don't think if there's anybody that wants that's planning for Ukraine to join NATO. But you don't. That strikes me as pandering. I don't want to give him that assurance. I don't ever want to tell a global rival what we will not do.
I don't disagree. But the ironic thing is that Putin actually achieved the aim that he articulated in 2014 with the conflict in Donbass. When he seized Crimea and instigated the separatist movements in Donbass, there was no way Ukraine was going to join NATO in the near term, because an accession to NATO has to be a net positive to the defense alliance. And if we were to say, Ukraine, please come in, which was part of the memorandum of understanding with Ukraine and Georgia, we would have to deal with either allowing Ukraine or asking Ukraine to cede those territories to Russia, or inherit a conflict between Ukraine and Russia into the NATO alliance, which is not something we want. And that would potentially, again, be escalatory.
All right. I want to plug everybody into Joshua C. Huminski, H-U-M-I-N-S-K-I is the Twitter feed. It is the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs. I know that name. What a legacy of foreign policy wisdom in the former Michigan congressman. What's your connection to his world and what's he up to these days?
He has a number of things on his plate. So he founded the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs when he left office in 2014 to keep a hand in the policy world and deal with issues very much like this. So we are a bipartisan institution that works within the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. That's a lot of names there, so I apologize. Trying to come up with creative solutions to the challenges facing American foreign policy from a country-first principle. We want to define the best outcomes for the country, and that's what he's up to these days.
Well, a pleasure to have you, sir. Appreciate it very much. Best of luck to you. Give our best to Mike. Big fan. And thanks for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is Joshua Huminski. The Twitter feed is Joshua C. Huminski, which makes it look like Joshua Chuminski. Don't be fooled. And he is the director of the Mike Rogers Center for Intelligence and Global Affairs. That was some great stuff. And because no matter what, if somebody approaches this with some wisdom, it doesn't mean you had to agree with everything Josh said. It seems like Mr. Huminski is, if you create a spectrum of bomb the hell out of them now versus, and on the other polar opposite is give him everything he wants, that there's a middle ground there. Mr. Huminski, I think, dwelled on some interesting stuff. Like, we need to talk tough, act tough, but you got to give Putin a way out to save face. Does that make sense? Let's bounce it off Rich Lowry at National Review, and let's do that next. Mark Davison for Hugh Hewitt.
It was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light.
The obviously recognizable Taxi from Harry Chapin. The album where we all discovered this, and by we, I mean those of us of a certain generation. The album was called Heads and Tales, T-A-L-E-S. Perfect title for a storyteller like Harry Chapin. Heads and Tales, that album where you found Taxi, was released 50 years ago this week. Ouch, I know. All right, it's the Rich Lowry Lightning Round. It's a compact segment, so let's say hi to the editor of National Review. Rich, good morning. Welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Nice to have you on.
Hey, how's it going?
It's fantastic. Let me dive into some of the things you've been saying of late. Obviously, 500 things to say about Ukraine, but you've been focusing a lot on oil and gas. Why do you think that the Biden administration is dragging its feet so agonizingly on doing the cutoff of Russian oil that even Nancy Pelosi wants to do?
Yeah, the same reason Europe is dragging their feet and may never do it. It's the price of gas. You know, it's already $4 a gallon or whatever it is most of the country, and that's a political pain point. Inflation is probably the thing that's the main domestic political anchor around this administration's feet. So it's really reluctant. I think it's inevitable. I think it's obviously a bipartisan consensus. And even if they don't want to do it, they'd get forced to do it by Congress. So eventually they're going to have to go along.
On the spectrum between not one drop of American blood for Ukraine when we can't even defend our own borders, and the other side of the spectrum, which is we should have been bombing stuff already by now for days, where do you think the American consensus is? Where's that needle moving?
You know, there's polling that shows people support a no-fly zone, but I think that's because people are not fully cognizant of what a no-fly zone actually means. So I don't think people, at the end of the day, really support a shooting war with Russia, which is what a no-fly zone would in effect be. Obviously, you'd need to shoot down Russian planes if they didn't honor the no-fly zone. Plus, you basically have responsibility for everything that happens, you know, once you've made that kind of intervention. And mainly what's happening, it isn't from the air. I mean, shockingly, the Russians haven't established air superiority yet. It's happening on the ground. It's a traditional Russian way of war, where you just rocket and shell the other side into submission. So the air is part of that, but it's really not the main effort. So I don't think a no-fly zone makes any sense.
Every time we begin to even think about this, it gets us to thinking about America's military capabilities writ large. And you've written a pretty interesting piece that seems to indicate we're simply not spending enough on the military in a still dangerous world. Tell me about your piece called We Need a $1 Trillion Defense Budget.
Yeah, well, in these war games, we actually lose in theater wars against Russia and China, and it's because these are two countries that have the kind of capabilities that used to just be our calling card, and we had exclusively, most importantly, long-range precision missiles. So we need to be very serious about this threat. The idea of fighting fighting two wars simultaneously is no longer just theoretical. You know, you could see in the real world how it could happen. And from, you know, 2012 to 2016, we drastically cut military spending. And the military and the Army and the Navy were at their lowest end strength since World War II. The Air Force was at its lowest level since its inception. And that's just not acceptable. So we're going to need more stuff. We're going to need better stuff. We're going to need different kinds of stuff. And I would expect next year the budget to be above north of $800 million, and I think it should go up to $1 trillion, which is about 5% of GDP, which is higher than it's been in a long time, but lower than it was during most of the Cold War.
In our final 60 seconds, I know we could do a whole segment on this. How do you think the Ketanji Brown Jackson hearings are going to go? I don't want to be too cynical. I almost feel like they floated her name, knowing that the oxygen would be taken up by Ukraine so that people wouldn't spend their time, you know, coming after her.
Yeah, it's the lowest impact that's ever been made by any Supreme Court nomination. You know, when you mention her, I'm almost like, who? What? What's going on? I think it'll be pretty. It'll be a pretty easy victory for them.
What should Republicans do? Are we still in a land that says a president, there's an etiquette that says a president should get his nominees, or should they look at her and know that she's going to be Stephen Breyer, she's going to be Elena Kagan, she's going to be Sonia Sotomayor, she's an anti-constitutionalist, and vote no on principle?
They should vote no on principle, because you can only vote for someone who is a constitutionalist. She's not. I suspect she's not going to be Elena Kagan, who's pretty clever and occasionally, you know, can work on John Roberts and get him away from the rest of the conservatives. I think she'll be a little bit more like a Sotomayor, who's just strictly political and is not very influential as a jurist.
Rich Lowry, editor at National Review, at Rich Lowry, LOWRY, and at National Review, NRO, in our online. Much appreciate you, Rich. Thank you, sir. All righty, as we roll into the next hour, we're going to take a look at some other guests, including one who says maybe it's time to think about overthrowing Putin. Either we do it or try to arrange for somebody else to do it. Is that a non-starter? Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. Stick around.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
Very much. Always a pleasure to fill in for Hugh Hewitt right before my own show. There's no better show prep for my own program here at 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth than to do the entire Hugh Hewitt show right ahead of it. Now, the entire show is with a bit of an asterisk today. We are together for here in the final hour for the first half of it. The back half is going to be Hugh on tape talking to wonderful novelist C.J. Box about his latest work. So that gives us, you and me, two segments. We're going to talk to a fascinating gentleman here in a minute who's written a very provocative piece. And then we'll have a chunk of time to just wrap up with phone calls. So grab a line, whether it's Ukraine or anything else. So much going on in the news. 1-800-520-1234. 1-800-520-1234. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Davis, M-A-R-K Davis. So as I said, whenever I'm filling in for Hugh, I take a look at just various things that people are saying, you know, columns that people write and all the big publications that I like. And if you noticed over the last few days, there's been a lot of questions of what Ukraine should do, a lot of questions what America should do, and a lot of speculation about how the Russian people are feeling about this. And it was the weirdest juxtaposition of events, because I took a call on my local show a few days ago, and a gentleman said, yeah, Mark, tell you what ought to happen is, you know, somebody ought to just flat out overthrow Putin or put a bullet in him or something. And, you know, listen, the world becomes a better place if somebody does that today at lunchtime. But that doesn't necessarily mean we can go about advocating it or mobilizing toward it. And then Lindsey Graham, like moments later, says, is there a Brutus in Russia? Can somebody take Putin out? And it just launched me into this fascinating internal and external dialogue over what the people of Russia might be able to do about the guy who, after all, is the problem. And so within that funnel, I then hop onto the Washington Times, and there is a column called People of Russia, It is Time to Overthrow Putin, written by the assistant commentary editor for the Washington Times, Jeffrey Scott Shapiro, who joins us. Mr. Shapiro, welcome. How are you doing, sir?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I am great. And my pleasure. And thank you for writing an absolute conversation starter. So I guess let's go like a flow chart. And so box number one is, how popular or unpopular do you think this Ukrainian incursion is with mainstream Russian citizens?
Well, I think it's very unpopular. You know, the reality is, obviously, you know, Russians have been drawn to war drums and chauvinism in the past. You know, internal polling has shown that 83% of the Russian population has a very favorable view of Ukrainians, and they feel very close to them. There isn't a division, really, between them. That's actually part of Putin's argument, right, that, you know, Ukrainians and Russians are one. So even though they've always been very, you know, hot for war drums and talk, there's a big difference between talk and actual war. And if you look at what happened to Putin's poll numbers right before the actual invasion, they jumped about 10 points from the low 60s to the high 60s, or early 70s. And then once the invasion started, it took more than a 20-point downturn, right around 50 and below. So it seems to be on a rapid decline.
A lot of what people have said about Putin, and of course you famously go back to things that Trump said about Putin, sort of identifying with his strongman imagery, while stopping short of everybody saying that Trump is lifting up or praising Putin. I think that's an unbelievably stupid narrative. But there is a kind of an embodiment of that strong man. I am strong. He is strong. Strong leaders. Look at it. But that's been shattered. You write about this in your piece. The notion of Putin, this hasn't lifted him up as a really strong leader. He is now, as you put it, he's just an executioner.
Correct. I think that he's being viewed differently. I also think that in a way, Putin did a disservice to himself and his united Russia regime. I think that in a way, he shattered his own myth. I think he shattered the myth of Russian military might to the entire world. I've been writing about Russian aerospace for several years because I find it really interesting. And, you know, they do have some very interesting innovations in terms of, you know, aerospace and aviation. We've been actually using Russian rocket engines to launch Atlas V national security, Atlas V rockets that take national security satellites up into space. So, you know, they have a lot of innovations. They've been taking our astronauts up to the International Space Station for years. And there was always sort of this myth that Russia was obviously extremely powerful. But what we're seeing unfold on the ground in Ukraine, I think, has really shocked and mystified the world. We're not seeing an organized military effort. What we're seeing is a lot of chaos, and we're seeing a lot of success on behalf of the Ukrainian resistance.
None of us has put Putin on the psychiatrist's couch, and wouldn't that be interesting if someone did? But what do you make of some of the folks from Marco Rubio to Condi Rice, who have some familiarity with him over the years, who say he may not have all of his marbles right now?
I think it's possible. I mean, I certainly understand that he's always been ruthless. He's always been a killer. He's always been an assassin. I don't take that away from him. But what we're seeing now, to me, defies a level of reason and rationale, right? Because you can always make the argument that even though someone is doing immoral things or hurtful things, that it's a version of realpolitik, right? And that might be the so-called, quote, admiration or soft praise that we see from some people with Putin that, you know, oh, he's a genius. He's brilliant. He does what he wants and he gets away with it. You know, the term rational, as we use it in political science, someone who's trying to achieve a goal and they're able to accomplish it for maximizing their power. This isn't maximizing Russia's power. This is actually creating a new image of Russia as a nation of defeat. And so I don't see anything brilliant about it. So I have to wonder to myself, what is really going on up there?
And that's a perfectly put question. And it jostles the notion, I mean, in the worst heyday of the Cold War, assured destruction, we're dealing with Brezhnev, Andropov, Gorbachev. No matter what you said about the evils of the Soviet Union, we had a kind of a residual assurance that they did not want to die, that they did not want to go up in a haze of glowing green glass. This is to differentiate from dealing with jihadists, where their leaders and some of their practitioner warriors, not only did not care about dying, they're all on board for dying. 72 virgins, the entire thing. But with the Soviets, we at least could say they had that thumb on the pulse of rationality, and we'd like to have that with Putin. But I don't know that we can.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You talk about the Soviet Union, right? And when you look at the Soviet Union, one of the things the Soviet Union had that I don't think Putin's United Russia regime has is an incredible Soviet bureaucracy, right? You know, you had the Soviet Supreme, you had the Politburo, you had the Communist Party, you had local Soviet collectives. You had this massive leviathan of a bureaucracy. And, you know, it was that bureaucracy that Brezhnev was able to unite and mount against Khrushchev in what was really a coup in 1964. And then when Brezhnev got into power, that bureaucracy just became bigger and became more powerful. So I think it was actually harder in some ways in the Soviet Union to sort of mobilize decisions. Whereas what you have now in Russia, people have described it as sort of a kleptocracy, right? It's almost like a organized crime syndicate that's running Moscow. You really do have an authoritarian ruler that can make unilateral decisions, and no one's really going to challenge him. I would actually put it on more par with something like KJU as opposed to the Soviet Union.
Jeffrey Scott Shapiro, former director of the U.S. Office of Cuba Broadcasting, now doing commentary editing for The Washington Times. In our last minute, I just wanted to ask you, what is or was the U.S. Office of Cuba Broadcasting?
It's actually the component of the agency that oversees Voice of America to broadcast pro-democracy messaging from the U.S. government to Cuba. And I was there as an advisor and the director during the 4 years I served in the Trump administration for the White House.
And how's that going? I mean, can people from Havana to its suburbs to across the island of Cuba, can they, you know, get a hold of a radio and hear pro-democracy messaging from America? And how much does it resonate?
They can, especially if they have shortwave radio, which the regime cannot jam. And even though they've been able to jam the U.S. Office of Cuba Broadcasting, otherwise known as Radio and Television Marti, within Havana by playing rebel radio over it, which is their state-controlled radio, it's heard all throughout the island. And there's a number of independent news sites, including ADN Cuba and others, that have been successfully getting through on social media and internet, where the Cuban people have really been getting an opportunity to read pro-democracy news and messaging. And I think that was a big part of what supported the uprising in July.
Well, listen, thank you for your service in that regard and for being on the show today, and love reading you in the Times. Appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much.
That is Jeffrey Scott Shapiro, and his piece in Washington Times is headlined, People of Russia, It's Time to Overthrow Putin. Wouldn't that be nice?
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.